branding, experience, conversation, promotion, powerful marketing, empowering small business to change their status quo. It's the Internet Show, all about small business marketing. Jay Arrett hosts the brightest minds in marketing. Power, power to the power. Small business.
And hello, welcome to my little internet thingy, Power to the Small Business. My name is Jay Arrett. I'm founder and chief officer of Awesomeness for The Marketing Spot, a small business coaching and consulting firm in Waco, Texas. Check it out at themarketingspot.com. I also pen a blog called The Marketing Spot Blog, which can be found, coincidentally, at themarketingspotblog.com. And yes, I am on Facebook, actually quite active on Facebook, facebook.com/themarketingspot. Even did a little live video gig, and I'm going to do it again on Wednesday in the afternoons, 3 p.m. Central. You know, one of the cool things about this podcasting gig is that when I read a good book, I can call up the author and ask them to be on the show. Then I get to pick their brain for about 30 minutes. I know, cool, right? And such is the case with a book I just finished called Consumerology, The Market Research Myth, The Truth About Consumers and the Psychology of Shopping. And the awesome brain I'm going to pick is the author of the book, Philip Graves. Now, in this episode, I'm going to focus on the psychology of shopping part, but I promise you, if you read the book, first, you'll never want to do a focus group again, and second, you might never again believe any study you see that predicts the future. Because consumerology really points out a fundamental flaw on which a great deal of research is based. Now, after my conversation with Philip Graves, I invite you to stick around. I have some announcements about what's coming up for The Marketing Spot and a future marketing resource for you, for all entrepreneurs, really. So check it out on the backside of the conversation with Philip Graves. But now let's dive into Consumerology with author Philip Graves. And we go to the Skype line now where we welcome consumer behavior consultant Philip Graves. He's author of Consumerology, great new book that I've been reading, The Market Research Myth, The Truth About Consumers, and The Psychology of Shopping. That sounds pretty interesting. Philip, hey, welcome to the big show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you on. Now, whereabouts are you in England?
I am in Cambridge. So I'm northeast of London. Is about 70 miles northeast of London, which to us feels like a long way, but I realize in your country that's almost a walk.
Yeah, and I'm in Texas, so yeah, we take that's our afternoon stroll here in Texas. Let's dive into your book a little bit, because I found it pretty fascinating, especially as it applies to small businesses. You have some amazing insights, I think, on the consumer and consumer behavior and understanding how the consumer makes purchase decisions. And what I got immediately from your book, that it's about the conscious versus the unconscious mind. Can you talk a little bit about how consumers make decisions when they purchase something?
As you say, it's a large part of the book. So just to kind of give you a flavor of it here, our brain operates at two levels, essentially. We have the conscious mind and our conscious thoughts, and those are things that we're very much aware of. We're aware when we're going through those conscious deliberations. And because it's something we're aware of, it's something that we feel happens an awful lot of the time. In fact, we misunderstand the extent to which it happens, because running in parallel with that is the unconscious mind. And that is driving an awful lot of how we respond to the things that we encounter, and also sending out if you like, feelings. Some people call it the emotional brain. I prefer to not generalize it in that way. But that's sending out a lot of messages that aren't picked up directly by the conscious mind, but are picked up indirectly. And as a result of that, all sorts of interesting things happen that we ourselves are not always aware of the mental processes that we have been through that have resulted in us taking a particular action. And so from a consumer point of view, that gets you into some very interesting areas, because consumers end up not being very good witnesses to their own behavior.
So we actually end up making decisions different from what we had planned to make, right? I mean, the unconscious mind kind of takes over, and we go into a store maybe planning one thing, and we walk out having done something totally different.
Absolutely. And you know, we might start off with an idea that we want something sometimes, And then as we go into that journey, we discover all sorts of complications and that perhaps the purchase decision is more complex than we realized. Perhaps there's more choice than we realized. And if you think about it logically, if you were going to walk into a store where there is, let's say, just 10 things to choose from that broadly fit the idea of what you want, and each of those 10 things might have, even at a simplistic level, sort of 3 points of variability, you're now talking about needing to be able to compare 30 data points. And, you know, whilst, yes, we could do that using our rational mind, it would take us a heck of a long time. And we would, you know, perhaps need some computing software or at least a notepad and a pencil to get to the bottom of it all. And you don't see consumers with notepads and pencils that often, or indeed with their iPads out when they're buying something fairly basic. And what's going on is that we're using unconscious processes that help us make those decisions much more quickly and broadly effectively, but they're far from faultless systems that we rely on, and they're open to manipulation, they're open to influence, and they're also some things that sometimes get the decision wrong, and they don't always leave us with an understanding of why we've done what we've done.
From a business owner's perspective, we like to think that the more information we provide a consumer, the easier it is for them to make a decision. But what I hear you saying is sometimes that's just not right. Sometimes the more information we provide to a consumer, the more difficult it makes for them to make a decision.
Absolutely. And to give you a sort of an illustration of the problems that can come about as a result of this, when people have more choice and when they are aware that there's more choice, they tend to feel less good about what they've chosen, which in many ways is counterintuitive. We would think consciously as we walk into a store, I want a big choice, I want lots of options. But in fact, what we end up doing is feeling at an unconscious level, we don't necessarily rationalize it this way, that perhaps one of those other choices was a better one. And choice itself, which is a fascinating area to get into, but is a kind of complex equation that's a byproduct of both the number of things, and as you suggest, the number of things you choose to tell a customer about it. And of course, as experts, as the small business expert, we know our product inside out. We know all the little details. We live with it all the time. We're aware of all the nuances, and we regard them all as important. But from a consumer point of view, this is quite often sometimes fresh information, and at the very least, you need to give them a series of steps so they can access things one point at a time and make simple, easy choices from a few things and work down a hierarchy that way if they're going to feel good and not do what they'll sometimes do when they feel overwhelmed, which is just simply to walk away. But they'll justify that to themselves as, oh, I didn't want to buy it today, or I couldn't really get the one I wanted. But the reality is you just haven't given them an environment in which they feel they can make a choice.
Yeah, because consumers don't like to say to themselves, I just can't make a decision here. I'm not prepared to make a decision. So they make up excuses for themselves and rationalize it in their own mind why they didn't purchase anything.
Exactly. I mean, there's one example, great example in the book, which came from one of my clients, a big electrical retailer in the UK. They did a study, asked people when they were leaving, why didn't you buy anything today? And everyone gave their reasons. And largely they boiled down to, you didn't have what I wanted. Now, fortunately, my client is of a somewhat skeptical frame of mind, like me. And so he set up some more questions that asked people as they went in, what have you come to buy? And guess what? People hadn't got a fixed idea about what they wanted to buy. But when they left, they hadn't bought anything. Now, what they were saying was, you didn't have what I wanted. What they really meant was, you didn't influence me to want something badly enough. But as you say, none of us would ever say that.
Help us then understand how we can help the customer purchase something then. Because if we give them too much information or too many choices, and we give them all this logical data for them to process, and it makes it tougher for them to make a decision, how can we then help consumers to make decisions once we get them into our store?
A large part of it is changing the way in which you think about the consumer who is visiting your store, who you're dealing with at your business, and stop thinking about them as conscious, rational creatures, and start to understand those unconscious mechanisms that are driving a large proportion of what they do. And just to emphasize the point, there are some people who estimate that the involvement of the unconscious mind versus the conscious is up to 95%. So, you know, we're talking about a huge chunk. And even if you were going to say, well, that sounds ridiculous, let's say for argument's sake, it's only 30%. Well, the vast majority of businesses have been focusing on the 70% to the exclusion of the 30%. So even though I would argue it's 80, 90%, there's even if you think it's less, there's still a good reason to focus on it. And I think that the key then is to look at the way in which the unconscious mind works and look at what it's trying to do for us. And if you understand its role in our brain, it becomes easier to understand how you might connect with it.
Just from your research and work you've done for your clients, what are maybe some top mistakes that businesses make, and how can we correct those in our interactions with the consumer?
Well, one of the things that the unconscious mind does is deals with getting things happening very smoothly, very effectively, so that we don't have to spend that time thinking about everything we do. So, you know, we learn, we start to walk, you know, it's quite hard going to begin with, but then we get the hang of it, we don't think about how we walk anymore. And one of the big mistakes that businesses make is, let's say that you've got a new product, you're putting something into your store, you've got something new, and you know that this is an interesting and great product. But often what companies haven't done is looked at how customers currently buy what they buy. And if what they're buying is currently pretty much a habitual process and a habitual purchase process, they're buying it without thinking about it because they've made a decision that product X is what I need. They know what it looks like. Their unconscious mind recognizes the pattern of the design. It picks it up, and that's something which is purchased in a split second. Now, there is no way that you're going to overcome that habitual purchase simply by putting a product which, when it's been looked at elsewhere in isolation, people have said, oh yeah, this is way better. There's no way people are going to buy that product because they're not engaging that part of their brain when they make the purchase. So they're just kind of zipping through, they're grabbing what they've always grabbed, and habit, the unconscious mind, is determining what they do. And there's another example within that, which is that something new, which feels like an exciting idea when we talk about it, is in fact very threatening to the unconscious mind because it comes with a huge amount of risk. And at the heart of us, for evolutionary reasons, we are designed to be reasonably risk averse, and our unconscious mind's quite good at protecting us from things which are new and potentially dangerous.
Consciously, we like to think that we're daring consumers, right? That we like to try new, bold stuff. But that doesn't always really play out when we're out there making purchase decisions and opening up our wallet and saying, yeah, I'll buy that. Something else you mentioned in the book is social proof too, right? We want to know it's safe to buy something.
Yeah, it's a similar thing. You know, we like to believe that we like new and adventurous things. We also like to believe that we're kind of lone spirits and we're very much our own people. And yet you've only got to stand back a very short distance from your own group and see how similar we all are. We're all doing the same things. We're all getting up at the same time of day. We're all going off to do the same sorts of jobs that, you know, we're doing the same. We've got the same sort of interests. You know, we're all very much copying one another. And although we don't see it that way, again, for evolutionary reasons, it's important to us to be social creatures. It's important that we blend in. And one of the things that we're very influenced by is what we see other people doing. Now, not at a level that we realize that that's why we want something, but if we see other people in a store, if the store looks busy, we will find ourselves wanting to go in there without necessarily consciously realizing that the presence of other people is what's influencing us.
And I want to get into a little bit here now, Philip, about getting good and accurate feedback from consumers, because when you get this feedback, which is largely what your book is about, the feedback we get is inaccurate because we're answering these surveys or whatever with our conscious mind. Let me tell a little story. I'm going to tell a little story on my wife. We were out at a conference in Las Vegas a month or so ago, and I took her with me. If you would have asked her in advance how she would purchase makeup or face cream, she would have told you something different than what happened. I returned back to my room in the evening, and she was kind of looking guilty, and she said, well, I did something today. I bought some makeup and some face cream. She says, I was in the mall, and this guy sold me one thing, and he sold me another thing. And it turns out that she ended up, before everything was done, she had spent $300 on makeup and face cream.
Ouch.
And if, yeah, ouch. But if you had asked her in advance, would you ever spend $300 on makeup and face cream? She would have said, of course not. I would never spend that much money on makeup and face cream. And so you would never put that product out there. But research just doesn't work that way. And that's why asking consumers what they would do is misleading, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it feels to us all that we know what we like, we know what we think. Is what, you know, is a kind of the default assumption that has driven the market research industry for the last 70, 80, 90 years. But, you know, it's just not true. And as you saw with your wife, and these, once you get primed for these examples, once you start to realize that this is the way we are, you will see them more and more and more and more. And so when you go to ask questions, whilst it's a well-intentioned exercise, the part of the brain that people are responding with is not the part, very often, that is making the decisions on which purchases are made and where all the influences and contextual elements that our unconscious is filtering and processing and that shape what we decide to do and how we feel and how we think. You know, they've all been stripped away, and what we're left with instead is this rational exchange that feels like it makes sense, but when you really look at the things that change what we do, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, that's kind of tough then for us to get accurate feedback. How can we really find out what consumers like? We want to know what we should sell to consumers, what kind of services they want. How do we get this accurate feedback from consumers so that we know we're heading in the right direction?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's something that small businesses actually, who may have felt that they're at a disadvantage against some of the bigger organizations, actually need to realize they are at an advantage, because what it comes down to is that there is no consumer crystal ball. There is no consumer insight that can cut to the heart of your issue and solve your problems for you. If there was, all these big companies wouldn't be making all the big mistakes they are, because a lot of them are spending a huge amount of money on market research. The answer lies in really understanding what's happening right now and understanding the moment when a customer makes a decision. And a large part of that you can do by just standing back and objectively watching what happens. Part of it's wrapped up there in the sales data. You know, the sales data doesn't lie. Now, it might not explain itself desperately well, but it doesn't lie. And if you overlay on that the dispassionate observation of seeing what people are doing, where they go, what they touch, what they look at, you will learn an awful lot more about those people than they will understand about themselves, because, as I say, they're not in a position to report it.
But let's say I want to launch a new line of products, and I've got a couple options that I want to launch, and I'm trying to make a decision about what to launch. And so I know that if I ask consumers directly, hey, which one of these do you like? I might not get accurate feedback after reading your book. Thanks for messing that up for me, by the way.
Yeah, no problem.
So products that have not yet been out on the market, what's a good way to find that out?
There isn't really a substitute for either good judgment, which is not as banal as it sounds, and I'll come back to that, or alternatively, live trials, split testing, live testing. Because it's only when all those contextual elements are there and only when the influencers are present that people will respond as they really do. So to give you an example, you might develop these two products, and one of them, for some reason, might be that much easier for a salesperson to sell. Now, if you're in a sales environment where the salesperson has a role, that may be all that matters. But you're not going to have that present in your balanced market research process that says, you know, oh, which of these do you prefer, A or B? And you've just stripped out the most significant contextual variable that is really going to drive what happens. Understanding right now and understanding how people are currently buying and trusting your instincts to some extent isn't as daft as it sounds, provided that when you make a decision, rather than sort of passing it out to market research and letting consumers tell you what they want, which will very often be wrong, and you've only got to look at the rate of new product failures to see that, you can trust your instincts, go with your best judgment call, and then learn from it as a result. And when that's happened and you stand back, you say, okay, I got it wrong. All right, well, I got it wrong, but because it was my decision and I knew what I'd base that decision on, I can reevaluate that decision and I'm learning. Whereas when you pass it out to market research, you go, well, we did the due diligence, we asked customers, no, it didn't work. All right, we'll move on to the next thing. And as banal as that sounds, that's very often what companies end up doing.
But then they have something to blame it on, though, too, right?
Well, absolutely, the scapegoat, you know, and it's a great way of passing the buck. But it comes to quite a big cost. And if you look at some of the great decisions that businesses have made, you know, they've come when when one person in an organization has turned around and said, actually, I don't believe this, when consumers have said something like August Bush, when he brought Budweiser to the UK, what did the focus group say? Oh, it's weak, it's watery, it's like kissing your sister, it's not a real man's drink. And he said, no, I'm going to launch it because I think it'll work. Of course, then you put all the Americana around it. You put all the money into it to back it. And, you know, you can buy Budweiser over here, it's fair to say.
Yeah, and you give another great example in the book, but one of the most famous ones is Red Bull, which they did a bunch of research on Red Bull before they launched it, and they found out that everybody hated the product, it tasted awful, nobody would buy it, and of course now it's a huge product worldwide. But that entrepreneurial gut that you're talking about, I mean, if people make purchase decisions with their unconscious mind, maybe we should make product decisions based on our unconscious feelings, our gut also, huh?
Yeah, I mean, this is where we get into an important semantic point that people talk about gut instinct. And I think it's really useful to think about what gut instinct is, because the unconscious mind isn't this blob that exists in our brains that is formed from day one and stays the same. It's an adaptive tool in our brains, and it's the byproduct of all of our experience, well, not all of our experiences, but a large number of our experiences that have formed to give us this, if you like, blueprint for how to navigate our way through life such that things turn out the way we want them to. If you look at business decisions, recognize the limitations of market research, which are, you know, they are significant, then you might say, okay, what else can we do? We want to make the decision on the basis of the best possible of understanding of what people are currently doing. And I'm all for squeezing all the understanding out of the moment of now, as I call it. But then we are going to have to build a bridge to what we do next. And that's a bridge. It's going to need a designer. It's going to need to be built. It's going to have to be created with the best of intentions. And it may not reach the other side. We might build it and it might fall down. But we'll learn from that process. And our understanding next time, you know, our adaptive unconscious will have learned through that process by being very tuned into it. And the next time, you know, we've got an evolved gut instinct, if you like. We have a greater chance of making a success. And that's where, you know, if businesses can orientate themselves in such a way that they can do live trials, they can do single store tests, they can move forward in smaller steps with lower amounts of risk, but putting in place all the context that will make the difference to whether or not someone buys or doesn't buy, you know, they can get all of that learning or the vast majority of it before they go to full scale, and they can train themselves in the process to develop a better and better understanding of their own business.
Great advice. And we have just scratched the surface here with Philip Grace. He's author of the book Consumerology, just released in November, The Market Research Myth, The Truth About Consumers and the Psychology of Shopping. Hey, Philip, we appreciate your time today. If people would like to learn more about what you do and your services, where can you be found on the web?
I am at www.philipgraves.net.
We will link to Philip's website and his book in the show notes of the podcast, so check those out there. And Philip, we sure appreciate your time today. Thank you for being on Power to the Small Business.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Philip Graves, author of Consumerology. And I'm putting this book on my recommended reading list, not just because it pulls back the kimono of market research, but because of the important insights it reveals on how consumers make decisions and how you can help them make those decisions. And I'll link to Philip Graves' website and the book in the show notes of the podcast, which can be found at powertothesmallbusiness.com. And now it's time for me to give you a little peek of what's coming in the new year with my company, The Marketing Spot. I'm in the process of not just rebuilding my website, but shifting my company in an effort to provide more practical help for more entrepreneurs and small business owners. Now, for the past 9 years, I've been a consultant to local entrepreneurs, for small business owners and solopreneurs all around the country. But in 2011, I'm going to turn themarketingspot.com into an online marketing resource for business owners everywhere. And I'm talking on-demand resource. It will be one central location for, if you have a marketing question, you can go to themarketingspot.com and access the information rather than having to go to the search engines and then trying your luck with the various sites that it comes up with. I'm also, for the first time, announcing group coaching, where I will work with a group of entrepreneurs, walking them through my four-spot marketing model while helping them build an awesome brand and a complete marketing plan. I've had several entrepreneurs come to me recently and want my services, but my consulting fee was just a little too much for them to bite off. So this is a way for me to make my system more accessible and more affordable to more entrepreneurs and marketing directors of various companies. Now, I've had this podcast for nearly 3 years. I've been publishing the Marketing Spot blog for getting close to 4 years. That's not going away, but the marketingspot.com will be different. It will be more tutorials, ebooks, webinars, and special features that will allow you quick access to the marketing resources you need to empower your business and change your status quo. This is a pre-announcement. I will continue to give you more information here in the podcast and also at my blog, which is themarketingspotblog.com. But I suggest you go to my website, the company website, themarketingspot.com, and sign up for the notifications of my latest news so you'll receive the updates as they happen. Then watch for the launch of the themarketingspot.com Resource Center, which is scheduled for January 3rd. But knowing how website redesigns and rebuilds go, I'm just going to say first part of January right now. My name is Jay Arrett. Remember, you can get show notes for this episode with Philip Graves, author of Consumerology, at the podcast website, powertothesmallbusiness.com. It's where you can subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. You can do it by email, by RSS feed, and yes, in iTunes. That way, you never miss an episode of the internet show that's all about small business marketing. Power to the small business.
You've been listening to Power to the Small Business with Jay Arrett, the internet show exclusively about small business marketing. Please see the complete show notes at themarketingspotblog.com. You can also listen to the show online and subscribe in iTunes at powertothesmallbusiness.com. Never miss an episode of the internet show all about small business marketing. Power to the small business.
And special thanks to Mary Lynn Foster of the Big Success Podcast for creating the opening and closing voiceovers of Power to the Small Business. You can find Mary Lynn at the Big Success Show, BIGGSuccess.com.